The Slime Mold and the Universe, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Our main story this week may blow you away. Actually, it should. We'll talk with two scientists who have used the feeding behavior of one of our planet's lowliest creatures to help model the distribution of dark matter and galaxies across the cosmos. It's a tribute to the benefits of multidisciplinary science. Bruce Betts will also be along shortly with What's Up. Bruce and I have a big announcement, too. Here's a preview. You will be able to join us for the very first What's Up Live, coming soon to a device near you. We don't have all the details yet, but it will definitely be on Thursday, April 23rd at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, or 2000 hours, 8 p.m. UT. Just a little casual gathering as we all shelter in place and flatten that damn curve. Lastly, my terrific live conversation with NASA Chief Scientist Jim Green and astrobiologist Penny Boston about life on Mars is now available on demand. The easiest way to find it is from exploremars.org. Here's an even quicker than usual review of headlines from The Downlink, the Planetary Society's weekly gift of great resources to fuel your love of space. NASA has begun a month-long celebration of the Hubble Space Telescope's 30th birthday. You can even find images it captured on your birthday. CHEOPS is ready to start revealing the diameters of worlds orbiting other stars. That's the European Space Agency's characterizing exoplanet satellite. And NASA has selected SpaceX for the delivery of cargo to the Gateway, that small, maneuverable space station the agency plans to put in lunar orbit. As always, you'll find all the cool stuff in the downlink at planetary.org/downlink, and you can also sign up to have it delivered every Friday for free to your inbox. Understanding the distribution of dark matter across the universe is one of the greatest challenges faced by astrophysicists and astronomers, surpassed, perhaps, by learning what the crazy stuff is in the first place. We can't see it, but its gravity appears to give shape and substance to the largest collections of regular matter in the cosmos, galactic clusters. Many theories and complex models have attempted to unravel what looks like a rat's nest of feathery filaments. We can probably assume that none of these efforts mean a thing to Physarum polycephalum. You may have seen it growing across decaying logs or leaves in a forest, or even on your front lawn. The spongy, bright yellow mass is just a slime mold. Nevertheless, the efficient way in which it seeks food has inspired a team of scientists. They have created an algorithm that may do a better job of modeling those filaments of dark matter than any previous attempt. The team includes scientists from the University of Massachusetts, North Carolina State University, and the Pontifical Catholic University of Valparaiso, Chile, along with several researchers at the University of California, Santa Cruz. That's where the two lead authors of the March 10 paper are. Joseph Burchett is a UCSC astronomer. His colleague comes from a discipline that may surprise you. Oscar Elek is a computational media researcher in the university's Creative Coding Lab. He has a background in computer animation. How these two young scientists came to realize that a slime mold could help us understand the universe is just part of what we covered in a recent conversation. Joe, Oscar, welcome to Planetary Radio. Congratulations on this work, which as soon as I got the press release, actually three press releases, I was just blown away. I am so glad to get you on the show to talk about this tie-in between a lowly slime mold and the largest structures in the universe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Matt.
As Jeff Goldblum told us in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. I don't think he had this in mind, but are you as amazed as I am by the fact that this living creature was able to help us learn something about, I already said it, the biggest structures in the universe? Joe?
Absolutely. This is trying to characterize, map out the cosmic web in the universe on the largest scales, using only the galaxies that we can go out and observe that should trace this cosmic web. This has been a difficult problem that many people have approached in a lot of different ways. Each of these methods that people have employed to try to address this problem have their strengths and weaknesses. It's taken a lot of effort, and a lot of people, a lot of really smart, talented people have lent their energies toward this problem. And when we started out to try and study the cosmic web for our own purposes, I very much had in mind all of this work that had sort of come before and was about to default to any of these other established, more conventional methods. Given that all of this effort had come before, it was especially surprising to me that turning towards this algorithm inspired by the slime mold was really the best application for our purposes.
I think initially the similarity was kind of visual. So my history and my background is in computer graphics, looking at how we humans look at things, how we see things, and how we can emulate that. And then, lo and behold, here we have this organism that looks very suspiciously like the cosmic web. Now, the organism is flat, you know, it grows in 2D, by which I mean surfaces of things, you know, dead trees, rocks, dirt, whatever.
Yeah, flatland.
Flatland, exactly. And the cosmic web is, you know, fully, beautifully 3D webbed network. But it's kind of like the characteristic features that stood out. You know, when you actually look at it closer, and that's when we had already had the hindsight of having done, you know, some months of work on this project, we saw this property of the transport network arise that we realized is kind of the main link between these two.
Joe, at first glance, you hear this and it just seems nuts. I mean, a slime mold's growth is not driven by the forces that form and arrange galaxies, right? I mean, that's kind of what Oscar's saying.
Yeah, hence my skepticism at the very beginning.
Right.
A non-believer.
Well, a true believer now.
Didn't
art play a part in this discovery?
Oh, yeah. The original connection was actually completely random. So I heard about slime mold before, I'm pretty sure Joe did before, but you know, we just didn't connect the dots. And then we saw work of this media artist, Sage Jensen, who's based in Berlin. This guy just created these beautiful animations just using the base algorithm that we started with, the work of Jeff Jones. He made it so beautifully stylized, even if just in black and white. The point is that you don't know what's underneath it on the first glance, but the behavior, the patterns and structures that it creates are just irresistible. And then when you look at the cosmic web, which I had the chance to look at just a month before, because we discussed this problem with Joe, things just fell into place. So yeah, this has been very important.
Joe, how did you begin to test this hypothesis? I know it involved this huge data set of galaxies.
The original project, this is a Hubble Space Telescope archival data research program. This program is funded by the Space Telescope Science Institute to essentially look at the large-scale distribution of galaxies, which large-scale distribution of galaxies forms the cosmic web, right? And to use the background quasars that shine through the cosmic web in the foreground, by studying the light of those background quasars, we're able to study the gas that comprises the cosmic web, or that is a constituent of the cosmic web, via its imprint on the background light. But essentially, the key data sets here, there's sort of two main data sets. One is from the Hubble Space Telescope, as I mentioned, but another is a sample of galaxies that were taken from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is an enormous survey, millions of galaxies that are arranged over about a quarter of the night sky. I had selected a small sample of these galaxies because if you essentially plot up, and this is true of any galaxy survey, if you just sort of plot up the locations of the galaxies, one can sort of intuit where the cosmic web structure should fall. Galaxies are apparently arranged in these sort of filaments, and they're seemingly empty spaces that are voids. this was sort of the initial application. Once Oscar went away for a weekend and he and his friend holed up and had their own little hackathon to do a lot of the work.
Good times.
to do a lot of the work on this on, you know, this algorithm and sort of the key innovations that they added to it. So we initially fed it this sample of galaxies, and the intuition, just what you see, as I said, when you plot up the locations of galaxies, you know, where you kind of intuit the filaments should lie. When Oscar employed his algorithm with this data set, what visually emerged was just such a striking match to, you know, that intuition. This was, you know, really an aha moment for me, and I, you know, erased 99% of my skepticism.
That's Joe Burchett. He and Oscar Elek will be back with more in seconds. This is Planetary Radio.
Bill Nye, the Planetary Guy here. You've heard Matt deliver highlights from The Downlink, our great space news digest. You told us you want more. Well, you've got it. The Downlink now includes cool space images and fascinating facts about the cosmos that you can share with your friends and family. Best of all, you can have The Downlink delivered to your inbox each week for free. Planetary.org/connect is where to go to learn more and sign up. That's planetary.org/connect for The Downlink.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Joe Burchett and Oscar Elek of UC Santa Cruz are the lead authors of a paper about finding inspiration and guidance regarding the distribution of galaxies and dark matter in the universe from a bright yellow creeping slime mold. Even more of my conversation with them is online at planetary.org/radio. Do I understand correctly, Joe? It's sort of at the intersection of these filaments where we tend to see galaxies forming.
Yeah, in particular, the sort of largest structures, the most massive collections of galaxies really form at the intersections of these filaments, the so-called nodes. So these are galaxy clusters and galaxy superclusters form at these nodes. Galaxies actually form all through the filaments themselves as well, albeit at much lower densities. So if you think about the intersections of filaments are really kind of the megalopolis, huge cities of the
yeah,
universe. and lots of interesting things happen in the big city in terms of the galaxies and the gas that live in them. A big part of this study was to try to understand the connection between where galaxies live, whether they live in the New York cities and the Tokyos and the Beijings of the world, of the universe, or whether they live out in the boondocks in, say, the Paintsville, Kentucky, where I grew up, a tiny little town way out in the country. Galaxies that live in relative isolation seem to have a tendency to form new stars. In one view, you could think of those galaxies living sort of longer, healthier lives in terms of, it seems like they typically have young stars in them, which means they've had recent star formation. Galaxies that live in the big city tend to be dead in the same view. I mean, they're no longer...
There's a striking similarity to the society.
Yeah, right.
The metaphor works, yeah.
But, you know, these galaxies haven't formed stars in a very long time.
Yeah.
Just trying to understand that process of why do galaxies out in the boondocks form stars profusely, and those that are in the big city, what's happening? And we think that's related to the gas supply out of which galaxies form stars. That's sort of the impetus for thinking about galaxies from an ecosystem perspective and thinking about the gaseous environments and transfer that must take place.
I am no astrophysicist or cosmologist. I just make my living talking to people like you. But this would seem to indicate a fairly major advance in how we can learn more about our universe, about the cosmos, and where it is headed, and perhaps a bit more of information about this mysterious stuff called dark matter.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of people are searching fervently for dark matter and signatures of dark matter. This method can provide sort of a signpost, or can provide guidance as to where to look.
Both of you embrace interdisciplinary approaches to science. It seems to me that we would not be having this conversation today if you didn't. Is this key to all of this?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I began interfacing with the lab Oscar works in shortly after I arrived in Santa Cruz. I was out at an open mic night. I'm a guitar player, singer-songwriter, where I went out to share a few of my songs. And another act featured Angus Forbes on drums. He runs the Creative Coding Lab. We were just sort of chatting after both of our sets. And he mentioned that he was an assistant professor at UCSC, and he was this expert in data visualization. He probably didn't phrase it exactly that way. He's a pretty humble guy. He mentioned that he's very interested in immersive representations of data and extending how humans interact with computers in terms of analyzing data. This data set from the project that we're working on here of all of these galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey immediately came to mind. And I'm like, I think I've got the data set for you. You know, if you're interested in sort of dabbling in astronomy, astrophysics.
Oscar, before you get into your own interdisciplinary leanings, there's one other thing I want to note, because Joe mentioned that he was a professional musician. I know you recorded albums, Joe, and that one of your bands was called the Mandelbrots. And Oscar...
Wow, I did not know that.
Oscar, you're kind of a fractal guy, aren't you?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. You just blew my mind. I didn't know that Joe had such a band. I know he had bands, but this he hid from me.
He talked about finishing a set at this open mic night. You didn't know he was talking about the Mandelbrot set.
Yeah, well, I played one of the Mandelbrot's biggest hits.
I mean, the guitar even kind of looks like the Mandelbrot. So, there might be something there.
Maybe. Another project to look into.
Well, musification of Mandelbrot set. Okay, check. So, yeah, it's... Honestly, I've, since the early days of my studies, I've kind of lived in the fractal universe, in the sense that fractals are a very essential structure in graphics. You know, they are used to generate visual content, like terrains and textures of rough materials, and just generally kind of the paradigm to think about all this visual complexity that surrounds us. To me, thinking about the cosmic web as a fractal was extremely intuitive, because that's how I've been approaching things for at least a decade now.
This has been delightful. Thank you so much, not just for the conversation today, but for bringing these interdisciplinary interests to light and making them work for us as we attempt to understand all that surrounds us, including the structure of the universe itself. This is very exciting stuff, and I look forward to hearing how things continue to develop.
A very pleasant conversation. Thank you so much, Matt.
Yeah, thank you. And we are looking forward to that as well.
UC Santa Cruz researchers Joe Burchett and Oscar Elek, lead authors of a March 10, 2020 paper in the Astrophysical Journal Letters titled Revealing the Dark Threads of the Cosmic Web. We've got lots of great related links on this week's episode page at planetary.org/radio. We've reached the time for What's Up on this edition of Planetary Radio, so I am joined by the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. That's Bruce Betts, and I want to amplify on that announcement I made at the top of this week's show, that we will join each other once again, except for the very first time, really live, not just Planetary Radio recorded live, but live. Live and in person, virtually, on Thursday, April 23rd, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 2008 p.m. UT, as you informed me, because you think in UT, I think, nowadays.
I do. For this,
well, that's good for us, because I didn't have to look it up. I guess we're going to call it What's Up Live?
Sure. That's catchy.
Well, it's either that or Random Space Fact Live, which is where we started with this. But it'll be fun because you can interact with us directly, at least through chat. Ask us questions, make comments, submit a poem. Bruce will have all kinds of cool stuff for us to talk about. I'll just be along for the ride.
Matt will be the key personality addition to the show, able to mock me when I can't answer a question.
Yeah, as I so frequently do. Anyway, that there'll be more about this next week. And of course, we'll have more details as well at planetary.org. And I'm sure it'll be pushed out through all the Planetary Society's social channels.
We were going straight to the sky in the morning east. We've got those three planets all lined up from upper right to lower left. We've got super bright Jupiter and yellowish Saturn and then reddish Mars. Mars and Saturn, similar in brightness, and Mars will be brightening and brightening and brightening through October at its opposition. And if you check it out on April 15th, the Moon will join the planets as well. Venus is still super bright in the evening west, and on April 26th, the Moon will join Venus. Venus is kind of careening upwards in the sky relative to Orion, or is Orion careening down? In any case, it'll be above Orion in the sky in the coming week. So Comet Atlas, we talked about last week, could be a naked eye comet in May, or there are some hints that it's starting to break up, so it may not be. So as always with comets, we'll see. On to this week in space history, 1961, first human in space, Yuri Gagarin. In 1970, Apollo 13 launched for what turned out to be an exciting trip. And in 1981, the first launch of the space shuttle.
Big virtual celebration, virtual Yuri's night, since we can't get together in person this time. It's coming up on, at least the main one, the consolidated one, I believe, is Saturday, April 11, if you hear this in time. I'm sure it'll all be captured on video so that you can enjoy it after the fact and celebrate that passage of humanity into space, just as Max the dog is.
That was actually Gracie.
Oh, sorry, Gracie. Good night, Gracie.
We move on to random space fact.
I guess they aren't impressed by your impression.
Oh, they're not. Well, it's hard to bark words. That's why dogs don't talk typically. So, Matt, speaking of isolation, Apollo astronauts at the moon were about 400,000 kilometers from everyone but themselves. Command module pilots who circled the moon alone were at times more than 3,550 kilometers away from any other human, the equivalent of being alone in L.A. and having the closest human be in Washington, D.C.
Hmm. Quite a distinction. And I think it got the gentleman who represents the answer for the trivia question that you're about to take care of for us, resolve.
It is not coincidental. All right, we move on to the trivia contest where we discuss this individual. I asked you who was the first person to do a deep space EVA, so outside of low Earth orbit doing an extravehicular activity, and I fear I once again have been caught not being specific enough, but it all worked out. How'd we do?
I am happy to announce this because Joseph Murray in New Jersey has been a faithful entrant for about 6 years at least. He's finally won. Joe, you did it. And
yay.
He says, although, and he thought it was Dave Scott, but what we've read is, and as a lot of you have said, that James Irwin sort of did a stand-up EVA, stood up in the hatch, but it was actually the honors for the first real deep space spacewalk, or EVA, extravehicular activity, go to his fellow crew person, Al Warden.
Yes, indeed. Al Warden and wanted to honor him. He just passed away 2 or 3 weeks ago.
He was just a wonderful man. I will read what a listener, Robert Laporta in Connecticut, said. He said he had the honor of meeting Colonel Warden 3 times, gentleman and a gentle person, special man in a very unique group of astronauts, those 24 brave men who went to the moon. All of them were men, of course. A terrific guy with a great sense of humor as well. Very lively. And I know this because I also got the chance to interview him for Planetary Radio. And we'll share that link once again. It's a very enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, that would be great.
What Bruce was referring to about the confusion, a lot of you said Al Warden, but also hedged your bets by saying maybe Neil Armstrong, because that, of course, was a couple of years earlier with Apollo 11 on the moon. But that's not what you were looking for, right?
No, but I probably would have accepted either since I was sloppy. Sorry. But random.org chose someone who did say Al Warden, which was my vision of floating in space between the moon and the Earth and going outside your space capsule. That seems kind of wild.
Mel Powell in California, he's one of those who hedged his bets. And he said, though, that he says, I'd say I'm starting to know how Bruce thinks, but that's just terrifying.
Save yourself.
I thought you'd like that. Joseph, you are going to win. Well, the honor is not dubious, but the prize may be. If you choose, Bruce and I will record a message for you, a personalized message. You can use it as your outgoing message on your voicemail system if you'd like to do that. Or you can just, you know, maybe put it on your MP3 or Bluetooth alarm clock and wake up to us every morning.
Or put it on a loudspeaker, broadcasting throughout the neighborhood.
We're ready to go on.
We're headed to X-15 pilots. I know you love the X-15.
Sure do.
Which X-15, you may just know this, Matt, but don't say it. Which X-15 pilots later flew on NASA spacecraft missions? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Well, I sure know one of them, but I won't say who because you've asked me not to. Otherwise, I would have. You have this time. You have until the 15th. That'd be what would have been tax day here in the United States, but we all know that that's been swallowed up by the pandemic we get an extra 3 months. Wednesday, April 15 at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And if you are chosen by random.org and you've got the right answer, you also might get a little personalized message from Bruce and me that you can do with as you wish. That's it.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what it would be like to be alone circling the moon. Thank you, and good night.
Well, I can only tell you that Al Warden said he loved it. He loved every moment of it. He loved the solitude as well, and being further from any other human being than anybody else has ever been. And that's in the interview I did with him. Hey, I'll talk to you next week, and also on the 23rd, when we will hear from everybody else as well for whatever we will end up calling it. I'll say, as a placeholder, What's Up Live for now. Thanks, Bruce.
Cheese Muffin Live.
What, do you have one in your hand, I bet?
No, I don't, but I'm going to.
That's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its never-slimy members who want to understand the cosmos. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Be safe, everyone. Ad Astra.